Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. This is indeed a momentous week. It's always momentous when you see kids suing the U.S. government over climate change. That is indeed momentous. Yesterday, in San Francisco's Ninth Circuit Court, a judge heard oral arguments in a groundbreaking climate change lawsuit. It's Giuliana v. United States. You're probably going to be hearing a lot more about it in weeks and months to come. The case was first filed back in 2015 against the Obama administration, and it was original in a lot of ways, not only in that it argued that the U.S. government was violating the constitutional and public trust rights of future generations to inherit a livable planet, but also because it was brought by a group of 21 plaintiffs. All of them were under the age of 20. The young plaintiffs are supported by attorneys and staff from the nonprofit environmental advocacy organization called Our Children's Trust. The lead attorney on that case, Julie Olson, has said, quote, "The Trump administration should not be able to dodge judicial review of such egregious constitutional infringements of these young people's liberties. They are knowingly destroying our climate system and the healthy futures for our young plaintiffs." The judge in yesterday's hearing in the Ninth Circuit issued the decision on whether the case can proceed to trial, and we are so fortunate to actually have one of the litigants and an attorney who was there in the court yesterday. 20-year-old Jacob LaBelle is from Roseburg, Oregon. He was one of the plaintiffs, and he said what is urgently needed now is a clear scientific and constitutional discussion, and he knows whereof he speaks. He comes from that small town in Oregon, but he's an aspiring citizen journalist in a lot of ways. But he grew up milking cows and gardening, and at the age of 16 ran a small-scale community-supported agriculture business. So now he's waded into the world of the law to try and protect the land that he loves. And we're so fortunate to have Jacob LaBelle here with us to talk about the lawsuit. Jacob, it is a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And you've grown up in this. We're going to talk to you about how you started some 2.5 years ago. But you're joined by Philip Gregory. Philip Gregory is co-lead counsel for Giuliana v. United States, and he's also a partner with the law firm Cotchett, Petrie, and McCarthy. There he specializes in complex business and environmental litigation. Philip was at the Ninth Circuit Courthouse yesterday for the oral arguments in the Giuliana case. Philip Gregory, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Renee.
And you're going to have to walk us through, us lay people, through some of the language that was used yesterday. But if it's okay, I'd like to start with Jacob. Jacob, how did you come to be involved in this some 2.5 years ago?
Somebody tried to build a pipeline in my backyard. That's the short version. But really what happened, like you said, I was growing up on this farm, and I don't think I ever really thought I would become an activist per se. I was going to heading out to community college, and one day I saw a map on a table that a company was going to come in and build a natural gas pipeline, and it was just about a mile out from the border of my family farm. The company was called Jordan Cove. And that's how I got involved. I started activism against that pipeline because it would be the biggest greenhouse gas emitter in my home state of Oregon. And I met other young people, and I met another young man who's also from where I come from, in Douglas County, who was also part of this lawsuit. And he got me involved. And I started learning more about it and got really excited about what was happening and the potential and the energy of this movement and of this lawsuit.
You've waded into some pretty deep waters here. Is there any point at which you thought, oh my, what have I gotten into here?
I mean, maybe, but in a good way, I think. I think that some of the problems, a lot of the problems that we're facing in our society and politics right now is that people, and especially young people, don't necessarily want or think that they can be involved to that level. And I think people need to really realize that it's not enough to just lead your daily life and go to school and go to work and eat and sleep. And we really need to figure out what our values are, what we stand for, and fight for those things. And so for me, it was just an opportunity to take it to the next level. And I was actually really grateful to have that opportunity, and it's taught me a lot, and it's been a pretty amazing and also pretty intense experience.
I can imagine being in front of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. I can imagine that intimidating a lot of people. Philip Gregory, you're the co-counsel with attorney Julia Olson on this case. So take us through what happened yesterday, if you would, in the Federal Appeals Court in San Francisco.
Sure. Let me give you a little background on the case. We filed the case in August 2015, as you said, against the Obama administration. 2 days after the election in November 2016, Judge Ann Aiken issued an opinion that said our case could go forward, that these kids had a fundamental constitutional right to have a climate where, in essence, they could live. If our government was destroying that climate, then these kids were being harmed by the government. The federal government then filed an answer in our case, as is typical in litigation, and we started down the path of what's called pretrial discovery. Then the federal government decided that it was going to file what's called a petition for writ of mandamus. And I know that's a confusing term, but what in essence that the federal government was trying to do is avoid a trial by going straight to the appeals court. So rather than have a trial, a judgment, and then appeal that judgment to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the federal government tried an end run around that whole process and trying to avoid the trial and trying to avoid putting the science on trial. And they filed this petition for writ of mandamus before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So yesterday, what we heard is oral argument before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on whether or not the government's petition should be granted and this case, in essence, derailed. We believe that the Ninth Circuit panel saw that it's inappropriate to proceed by way of a petition like the government did, and we believe that the Ninth Circuit panel is going to, in essence, return this case to the district court to proceed to trial and a judgment before coming up through the normal appeals process.
So it could be weeks, maybe even months, before they come back with a decision about whether this can proceed.
Yes, hopefully soon. We now have a February 5, 2018 trial date up in Eugene, Oregon, and we'd like to get a decision soon so we can meet with the court and see what Judge Aiken is going to do about that trial date.
Well, part of the government's argument was that these young people didn't even have standing. In other words, they have no standing to even bring the lawsuit at all. So was that dismissed out of hand?
Well, so the doctrine of standing has three parts. The first part is each plaintiff has to show that he or she was somehow injured. That second part is that injury was caused by the defendant's conduct, in this case, the government. And the third element of standing is that the court can do something about it. The court can issue an order that will remedy the problem. So the issue of standing, for purposes of the Ninth Circuit argument yesterday, was primarily focused on the issues of causation. Did the government cause the harm, and can the court issue a remedy dealing with climate change in the United States? What's important to understand is the federal government has made admissions in our case where they agree that these kids are being harmed and that harm is serious. So the issue for trial is going to be, what was the role of the federal government in causing that harm? And we have alleged the federal government has had a major role in causing that harm, and we hope the Ninth Circuit will allow us to put that issue to trial in February 2018.
Jacob LaBelle, how old were you when you first started getting involved in this case?
18.
And from that time to this, it must have been a very steep learning curve. Tell me what has surprised you most about what's happened so far. Shocked, even. Has there anything that really shocked you?
There's definitely been, I think I'll start with a good moment. Just before we went to the Ninth Circuit, a lot of organizations filed writ of not writ of mandamus, but an amicus brief, and to support us,
friend of the court,
support us, stand with us in case, and file legal briefings to explain why our case should go forward and should go to trial, and that our case should be heard. And among those amicus briefs were the Sierra Club, Urge Justice, the Union of Concerned Scientists, Catholic organizations, the San Francisco Zen Temple, a bunch of interfaith organizations, and 63 distinguished law professors from around the United States. And that was one of the most amazing moments since I joined the lawsuit. That just really, it just made me really, really happy that we had all this amazing support, and kind of shocked that I was part of such such a movement and such a big case. And then, I mean, there's been the length of the process that we've had to go through, but I think that we've accomplished an enormous amount. I mean, it's been 2 years since we filed, and of course we're still going, you know, we still haven't gotten to trial. But like I said, we've built this enormous movement, and people all over the U.S. have heard our stories and the stories of my fellow plaintiffs of how we're personally impacted by climate change in real time. Like my friend Levi, who's 10 years old, had to evacuate Hurricane Irma. My friend Jaden had her house damaged by historic, unprecedented flooding in Louisiana. And that was all happening, you know, in her case, like 2 days before we had a hearing in the court in district court in Eugene. And so all this, yeah, I think, is really helping to educate and inspire people, and especially young people around the U.S. and around the world.
And the youngest plaintiff was, I think, 8 when you first started, right?
Indeed. That was Levi.
And what has been their experience, as far as you can tell, the really young ones?
Right. Well, I'll give Levi's example. But I think all of the younger plaintiffs I found are extremely engaged. They're extremely powerful individuals. Some of them are much better public speakers than I am, and with much less practice. And, you know, they may not grasp to the fullest extent of a climate scientist the entirety of what's going on, but they are doing their level best to keep up with the science, to understand it more than most adults that I know. And they made this decision themselves to join this lawsuit. Like, it wasn't their parents that were like, no, you should totally, you know, sue the U.S. government. They heard about this effort. They were already involved in most cases in environmental work in their communities. And they really, really cared about those places that they love. And they understand that, you know, those places and those natural resources and the whole fabric of society that depends on a stable and healthy atmosphere may not be there for them when they grow older, and may not be there for their children either. And so I've just been amazed at their energy and their engagement.
You are even quoted as saying, "I am telling my government to stop aiding and turning a blind eye to the corporations who profit off destroying our resources, climate, and environment, and start acting in the interest of its people. Our lives as young people may depend on it." That's serious thought. And to what extent do you really have hope that it's not already too late? We're talking about the most recent study. I think it was just released this year. The temperature's already 1.9 degrees higher. And that's just over the last year. So are you really concerned that this might be a real uphill battle?
Well, hope is a funny thing. You need to have hope to take action, so to speak. And I think there's nothing else we can do at this point except, you know, do our best every day and act to the fullest of our ability to stop this problem. And that's what I feel that I'm doing in this lawsuit. I do think that it is possible to have a remedy. And I do think the government, the U.S. government, has an enormous part to play in that, because if we can get all the agencies to cooperate on a national science-based climate recovery plan, which is what we're asking in this lawsuit, that's what we're demanding from the U.S. government, as well as, you know, that involves stopping permitting for pretty much all new fossil fuel infrastructure, or that would be things that would come up, let's say, as part of such a recovery, or drawing down carbon through the atmosphere, possibly through reforestation, or taking care of our soil, or changing our agricultural systems. I think such things have been done in the past, for example, in World War II, when we mobilized the entire country and completely changed the face of our country because of a grave, grave threat to the entire world and to our nation. I think climate change is a much graver threat. It threatens the stability and vitality of our entire planet for the next 100 years or more. I definitely believe that we can do it. And touching on the point that I made in that quote, I really think it's important to understand why we're having to bring this lawsuit. Why are kids having to go to court and sue their government to get climate action? And the problem that I see is that the executive branch, the legislative branch, have not been doing their jobs for over 5 decades. And a large part of that is also because of corruption. And we see that a lot. I mean, 75% of Trump voters, according to a conservative poll, actually support promoting renewable energy. And so those people don't have a mandate to destroy our national monuments, to dump fracking waste in the Gulf, all the things that they're doing, drilling. And they're doing it anyways. And the legislative branch is letting them, you know, get away with it as well and aiding them. And so that's why we have to use the judicial branch and use our system of checks and balances to ensure that our constitutional rights and our future is protected.
We'd like to invite our callers to just find out how this group of young people might in fact be the last bulwark that we have, given that there's an administration, as Jacob said, that seems to have a relationship with corporations that is taking the country in a completely different direction. It's almost like whiplash. There's been such a tremendous change in direction in terms of our environmental policy. If you have questions for Jacob LaBelle or Attorney Philip Gregory, please give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Philip Gregory, is there a precedent for this kind of a case, or is this unprecedented?
In one respect, there's a lot of precedent, but as Judge Aiken observed in her order, it really is an unprecedented case. Where are the precedents? Well, let's look at the decisions such as Brown versus Board of Education. In between the time of Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, when the whole concept of separate but equal started, all the way up to Brown versus Board of Education, there was what the court found a deep-seated psychological harm that was occurring to kids. And if you read the Brown versus Board of Education decision, it's based on expert testimony that school children were being harmed by the then existing school system. And the courts took on the system of segregation in the schools and said it's got to stop nationwide. And it's then sent the case back down to the various lower courts to attempt to try to get the school districts and other governmental bodies to develop plans so they could go forward on a completely equal protection basis. Well, our case, we have harms being inflicted on these kids. The evidence is going to be clear. As Jacob pointed out, we've got sea level rise for Levi. We've got Jaden home being flooded. Those are real occurrences, and they're going to happen with greater frequency and greater intensity, just like the kids in Brown. And it's up to the courts, because as Jacob pointed out, it's going to be no legislative action, presidential action, continuing to harm the kids. So the courts have to step in and issue an order that this harm must stop. And that's the precedent. It's the Brown versus Board of Education decision. It's the recent decisions involving the California prison system, where the prison system was overcrowded by more than 200%. There are a number of decisions where the courts have stepped in and addressed on a nationwide or statewide or school district-wide basis harms that are being inflicted on citizens by the government. And it's that those cases that we're using as our precedent.
Now, are you going to have to prove specific and personal damage? For example, do you have to prove that the litigant's home was damaged or that one of them is suffering from asthma or some specific damage among these plaintiffs?
Exactly, Renee. That's the part of the standing analysis. They're going to have to prove that they've been injured and then that the injury has been caused by the federal government. But we have admissions from the federal government in our case that climate change is endangering these youth's public health and welfare, as well as future generations due to such issues as carbon sinks. So we have admissions that the harm is occurring. We now need to just tie it in to these specific plaintiffs and then do a causation analysis as to the federal government. And in my mind, we win the liability phase of the trial.
There's also something called the public trust doctrine, and that doctrine says that governments are supposed to hold natural resources in trust and protect them for the people. Is that part of the argument as well?
Absolutely. So the public trust doctrine goes back to Roman times, and it says that there are essential natural resources and that are sovereign, whether it's the federal government or a state government, has to make sure that it holds these resources in trust for future generations, that we don't want to destroy everything or seriously harm essential natural resources. My way of thinking about it is when I used to go backpacking, I'd come upon a campground, and my view was I was to leave the campground better than I found it. I'd pick up whatever litter was there, make sure I didn't leave any litter on myself, and then I cleaned everything up. Well, that's what we should be doing. We should be cleaning up our campground. Under the public trust doctrine, it says the federal government is supposed to be doing that. But as we all know, this federal government is not doing that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with attorney Philip Gregory. He's co-lead counsel for Giuliana v. United States. It's the case where young people are suing the government for not doing more to mitigate climate change. Philip Gregory is a partner with the law firm Kochet, Petrie & McCarthy, and they specialize in complex business and environmental litigation. So he's the one that we can ask the legal questions of. But also joining us is 20-year-old Jacob LaBelle, and he's from a small town in Oregon, and he's one of the 21 young plaintiffs in this case. And we're really looking forward to your questions. 866-798-8255 is the number. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, Jacob and Philip will be joined by Michael Berger, Executive Director for the Sabin Center for Climate Change at Columbia Law School. And we'll continue with the conversation right after this. Hello, welcome back. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And if you're just joining us, with us today is Jacob LaBelle. He's a 20-year-old from Roseburg, a small town in southern Oregon, and he's one of the 21 young plaintiffs in a case you're no doubt going to be hearing a lot more about. It's 21 young people suing the U.S. government for not doing more to protect the environment and for actually contributing to climate change. And joining him here in studio is attorney Philip Gregory. He is co-lead counsel in that case. It's Giuliana v. United States. And Philip Gregory is a partner with the law firm Kochet, Petrie & MacArthur, and he specializes, MacArthur, and he specializes in environmental litigation. And joining us now on the phone for the second half of the show is Michael Berger. Michael Berger is Executive Director for the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia Law School. He leads a team that's at the forefront of domestic and international efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and promote climate change adaptation. So we're very grateful to have Michael Berger here. Hi, Michael. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yes, indeed. You wrote an article that went into what amounts to a conspiracy, government and corporate partnerships, if you will, that are leading to the conditions that these young people are suing over. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, I believe you're asking about the article I wrote about another set of lawsuits that were filed recently in California by a handful of local governments, including the city of San Francisco and the city of Oakland.
Assault on climate.
Yeah, against the fossil fuel companies. These are lawsuits that were filed under state common law. There are state nuisance claims that are filed by these cities against and counties against the fossil fuel industry, claiming that their contributions to climate change are a violation of their rights under state law, and seeking damages. In the Giuliana case, the youth plaintiffs are seeking a directive to the federal government to take action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and deal with climate change. In these lawsuits, the cities and counties are seeking compensation for the costs of adapting to climate change impacts that result from sea level rise in particular. And at the heart of those cases is sort of the long history of fossil fuel industries' attempts to obscure the debate obscure climate science and make it seem as if there's a debate about its validity. So there's this sort of long history of fossil fuel companies challenging climate science and paying for others to get out in the public and challenge climate science. And that's a core part of these other lawsuits.
Well, I think people are probably a bit perhaps surprised that the lawsuit that was filed in Giuliana was actually not started under the Trump administration, but under the Obama administration. So what does that say in your mind about how far even a supposedly environmentally friendly presidency can be from the goals that you say that need to be met?
Well, the Obama administration in the second term did make a pivot towards climate and started using the existing authorities that were available and are available under existing federal statutes like the Clean Air Act to begin to address climate change. But, you know, in order to effectively address greenhouse gas emissions, we're really talking about an economy-wide transition away from fossil fuels. And that's not the sort of thing that can happen in a two-year period of time or a five-year period of time. It's really a generational issue, and it's going to take a good deal of time to get that right. The Obama administration had begun to take actions, and it had set a goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector by 26% to 28%, by 32%, and reducing emissions across the economy by 26% to 28% by 2025. The arguments that the plaintiffs in the Giuliana case were making was that it's just not big enough, fast enough. And so they brought the claim against the Obama administration, seeking greater ambition and a more comprehensive approach that would address not just emissions from cars and power plants, but also the emissions that eventually result from fossil fuels that are extracted from public lands. So I think that, you know, what it says is that there is a lot that needs to get done, and while under the Obama administration the process was initiated, it was nowhere near to completed.
As a matter of fact, there's a lawsuit against the Department of the Interior about leasing coal on federal lands. Is that right?
That is right. There is a lawsuit that is challenging the failure of the Bureau of Land Management and the Department of Interior to conduct a programmatic environmental impact assessment that is for leasing coal from federal lands. The argument being that the last time the agency took a real look at the environmental consequences of leasing coal from federal lands was over 30 years ago. The Department of Interior under President Obama had initiated a new environmental review, which was then canceled when the Trump administration came in. And so this is a lawsuit that's seeking to require the agency to undertake that review now. At the same time, there are challenges to coal leases, individual coal leases as they're coming up. And there are challenges to individual oil and gas leases as they come up as well. What we're really seeing is that environmentalists and local communities are taking to the courts to seek to stop the government from sort of extracting, leasing public lands for fossil fuel development, in part because of, and in large part because of the consequences that those fossil fuels have for climate change.
We have an email from a listener, Debbie Bayer, out of Richmond, California, and she says, I was so excited to hear about this lawsuit. It's so easy to think that the Trump administration does not care about the environment and is suppressing the lawsuit, but it's harder to imagine that Obama was responsible. Can you talk about that? Because I think, Jacob, young people had a lot of hope in the Obama administration.
Yes, indeed. And I think I think what Michael Berger actually just talked about is very accurate, and in my view as well. I also want to point out that Obama did. There was one speech in particular that kind of shocked me, where I believe he said, "We've built miles and miles of pipelines in this country since I got elected," or something to that effect, which kind of shocked me that he was almost boasting about that, and that was kind of contrary to my previous views of. So I think there was definitely some things that could be fixed, and like Michael Berger said, the actions that were taken were definitely nowhere near close. Some processes were initiated, but it was not enough. And I do want to point out that the advantage of our case going through the judicial system is that we can ensure that long-lasting process of transitioning to a renewable economy, because if you're changing administration every 4 to 8 years, and like we've seen now, the processes initiated under Obama are now completely annihilated and basically thrown in the garbage by Trump to some extent. That can't happen if you have a court order that is telling the government agencies to all work together and come up with policies that actually ensure that we will not experience, that you know, my generation will not experience the very severe effects of climate change. So that's just like under Brown versus Board, the courts oversaw a lengthy, complicated, systemic change in our education system. And so that's exactly what we're looking to happen under climate change, and that's exactly the advantage of going through the courts.
And oddly enough, when I spoke to attorney Philip Gregory about who would be able to talk most about the science, the scientific evidence, he said, Jacob is your guy. So you're the wonk, you're the scientific wonk. Is that what drives you, that you actually understand the natural world in a way that you feel makes you really, really worried about the trajectory that you see the country on? What's the science behind your concern?
Well, I think the science is, first of all, pretty simple. You put carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and anything under it, and the planet starts warming up. That's the basic concept. I wouldn't say I'm definitely working every day to deepen my knowledge of the science, but I definitely think that, in a way, the basic concept is simple, but how it's going to impact individual communities and the local weather level, and you know how much these hurricanes are due to climate change and all that, that actually requires a lifetime of involvement and work within your particular field. And it's really hard for a single person to have that entire context, because this is a problem, a scientific problem on the scale of something we have never seen before. So we're very confident about, you know, what's happening. I've dug in depth into the graphs. You can go anywhere on NASA and you can find the graphs of how our carbon emissions or parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere right now are, you know, way above what we've seen in the last millennia, and how the change is happening so much more rapidly. And that scares the heck out of me, because you can look thousands and thousands and thousands of years back, and they can do that by looking at the ice cores and looking at the air composition in those bubbles that were stored away, you know, millions of years ago. And so that's, you know, for sure, we're in unprecedented territory. That alone scares me. But for the more particular details, I really rely on our experts, like Dr. James Hansen, who is a plaintiff on our lawsuit representing future generations. And, you know, we have some of the pretty best, I'd say best leading experts in the world on coral bleaching and forest impacts, all the impacts of climate change around the world, that are going to be presenting their evidence at our trial. And so I really rely on those experts for the science.
Okay, we have a call from Vicki in Berkeley. Hi, Vicki. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for all of your work and this program. I'm grateful. Thank you. So I have two questions. The first is I wanted to hear about the active people in the lawsuit in terms of representing diversity, inner city, rural, cross-country, cross-class, and cross-ethnic background.
Good
That's
question.
One.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I'd like to hear about is just other things people can do, because if you get too overwhelmed, you don't act. And so I like the piece about hope and to hear more about what people can do.
Two excellent questions, actually. Thank you very much, Vicki. All right, Jacob, can you describe your fellow plaintiffs?
Indeed, it would be my pleasure to. When I joined this lawsuit, I think one of the first thing that came out to me was what a beautiful group this is. And over the 2 years, we've become basically family, and my best friends are within the plaintiffs. And I would say that, I think when they first started, our Children's Trust sent out a call across the country, and interested youth basically reached out and became part of this lawsuit. And what we got was an incredible diversity. So, for example, Jamie Butler is from the Navajo Nation, and her family is impacted by drought because they live in the desert. Levi, as far as age, we have like from 8 years old when he started the lawsuit, now 10 years old, Levi in Florida. Victoria Barrett in New York is a very active and super inspiring social justice and environmental activist. Shiteska Martinez, some of you may know his name, eco-hip-hop artist, and he's pretty much a celebrity by now. He's been in environmental work since he was 9 years old, and was on the Bill Maher show recently and traveled all over Europe, and he has indigenous roots from his Aztec ancestry, and is an amazing, inspiring individual. That's just a few examples. And of course, I come from a very rural, very conservative community, and my fellow plaintiff Alex does as well. And so we kind of reach out to those people and have those conversations. It's a beautiful group, and I'm really grateful that we have such a diverse community.
Michael Berger is Executive Director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia. My guess is that you might feel like Sisyphus sometimes, kind of pushing that stone up the hill, watching it roll down a bit, having to push it back up again. And I'm hoping, assuming, that these young people give you some hope. But you also work on international efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And I'm wondering if what's happening internationally might be giving you even more hope than what you see happening domestically. For example, yesterday, the World Bank announced it will no longer finance oil and gas projects after 2019. Does that give you hope?
Absolutely. In the wake of Donald Trump's announcement of his intention to withdraw from the Paris Agreement in 2019, the rest of the world has sort of mobilized. And the great fear, I think, surrounding the talk around whether Trump would withdraw and what his withdrawal from the Paris Agreement might mean. There was a lot of fear about what that might do and what it might instigate, and whether there would be a parade of other countries and stakeholders who would walk away as well. And in fact, we've seen just the opposite. And now, the U.S., by virtue of this announcement of the intention to withdraw, is the real only outlier in the world. And at the same time, we've seen subnational actors within the United States and cities. We've seen corporations, we've seen other countries, and we've seen the international financial institutions as well step up. And what we're seeing is a rededicated commitment to addressing the drivers of climate change. The courts have a role to play in that without a question. And undoubtedly, this lawsuit, gives hope, if not because it in itself will change the world, which it may or may not do, but because of the involvement of youth and the way in which it has mobilized, really mobilized a conversation all around the world about this critically important issue.
And Attorney Philip Gregory, I imagine you get some hope, too, from the fact that several fossil fuel lobbies had been involved in trying to stop this lawsuit, and they recently pulled out or they're no longer involved. So can you explain why they were involved in the first place and why they stepped away from it?
There were three trade associations, including the American Petroleum Institute and the National Association of Manufacturers, who intervened or came into our case voluntarily as defendants because they argued to the court they should be at the table when a decision is rendered, because our lawsuit going after the fossil fuel energy system will seriously impact their business, significantly have a economic effect, as Michael said earlier, on what their members are doing. So they came into the case, they made various legal arguments, but when these trade associations were required to make admissions about whether or not climate change is occurring, for example, or how severe climate change really is, they withdrew from the case rather than take a position. Clearly, they didn't want to take a position that climate change exists and is a problem. And so when the court forced them to do that, they withdrew. This then allowed us to refocus our case on the federal government, where we believe the case should be tried.
And that feels like victory.
It certainly does. It certainly does.
Michael Berger, I'm also I read an article recently that outlined an October 22nd meeting of state and federal judges. They were on an all-expense-paid trip sponsored by George Mason University Law and Economics Center in Arlington, Virginia. And it was the first of several seminars promoting skepticism of climate change science. And those who were there were among the likely candidates for some of the 140 or so federal judgeships that President Trump will be filling. So I'm wondering, given that the decisions that are being made by the Trump administration that could have a generation-long impact, how concerned are you about lifetime judges that are perhaps climate skeptics?
Well, I'm very concerned about that possibility. I don't know anything in particular about that meeting, I don't know how effective that meeting may have been in sort of indoctrinating judges into climate skepticism. But I think that the issue that you raise points to, you know, the larger a larger issue to which this is all connected, which is fundamental threats to our democracy that are represented by the Trump administration, and certainly this administration, you know, with the assistance of this Congress and this Senate, it's in a position where it can rapidly fill a lot of judicial positions, and that it's in the process of doing that. And as we all now know, that can have tremendous consequences, not just for climate change, but for all sorts of things, and all kinds of critical issues. The attack on our democracy, though, is far from limited to the environmental law field or climate change in particular. And you know, one thing I'll just say about that, without going into the vast range of civil rights issues that can come up, is just in thinking about the basic operation of our administrative state and the way in which it relates to the courts. What this administration is really seeking to do is to stop the government from working. And it's seeking to do that by putting a delay on rules that have been finalized and put into place by the previous administration, by revisiting decisions that were made by the previous administration, and going back much further to as far back as 1996 when it comes to some of the national monuments that are being reviewed and that have been that Trump has already sought to shrink the size of. You know, it's really sort of an all-out affront on the very notion that our governmental institutions can provide any kind of stability, any kind of regular, reliable, final decisions that businesses and citizens can rely on. What this administration is seeking to do is to call everything into question so that any future administration can at any moment upend the entire thing. And I think that's a real threat. And I think that the courts are exactly the place to push back at that. And we're seeing a lot of pushback in the courts and a lot of litigation over these attempts to attack the administrative state altogether.
Jacob, that's what you were saying, that every 4 to 8 years or so, you know, you don't know what's coming next, or how do you plan? Yes?
Exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's what I think. That's why I part of why I joined this lawsuit. Yeah.
And isn't it kind of shocking still that, I don't know, if you're going to roll back regulations, that's one thing. But shrinking bear's ears and grand staircase Escalante, what do you think is at the core of this administration's, if you can, you know, get into their minds, Philip Gregory, figure out what do they think is critical mass here? What are they after?
Well, clearly, as Jacob pointed out earlier, this is an issue of corporate greed. And they think they can beat us by forcing us to play, I don't know if you're familiar with the game Whack-a-Mole, where the mole keeps coming up and you keep trying to hit it. What they're trying to get us to do is silo these cases. And then they're hoping over the long term to, through delay in the courts, through the judges they appoint, that they're going to end up getting what they want. And that's why we believe a systemic case like we're bringing is really fundamentally necessary because, as Michael said earlier, it's an economy-wide, it's a systemic problem that climate change is occurring, and to address it by reducing fossil fuel emissions, stop taking what I'm going to call the bad stuff out of the ground, what we've got to do is work at a systemic basis. And as Jacob pointed out, if we're going to do that, we need a court that's prepared to be there over the long haul and will not, call it change, depending upon whose administration is in and what dictates, whether they're corporate greed or whatever dictates the administration's doing. We need a judge who is objective, who's making decisions based on the best available science and issuing orders in light of that science.
Well, given that constitutional rights are at the core of your argument here, any chance that it'll go to the Supreme Court? What are the chances?
We firmly believe that should the federal government lose, that it will be bringing this case up through the appellate process all the way to the Supreme Court. And obviously, if we are found to be lacking and we do not get a judgment in our favor, we intend to go up to the Ninth Circuit and to the Supreme Court as well. But we have faith that courts are going to find that our case can proceed and that they'll issue a remedy based on the scientific evidence. Because, Renee, remember, in a courtroom, alternative facts, that's perjury.
There's just no such animal, right?
That's right. That's right.
Well, we're going to be coming to the close of the show now, but how do you think that citizens or organizations or cities and states should be fighting the administration's rollback of environmental protections? Jacob, I'll start with you.
The first thing I'll say is together, united as a country. And what I found during my 2 years being involved in this lawsuit and environmental activism is that climate change is an enormous challenge, but it's an enormous opportunity because it literally affects everyone. It affects the poorest and the most disadvantaged populations worst, but really on the long term, it really affects every single one of us and all of our children. And so in our current fractured, divisive, you know, really filled with hatred political arena right now, I think climate change is an opportunity if we can rally around the science and the values that we hold dear, that our, you know, constitutional fathers wrote into the Constitution, protection of life, liberty, and property, and think about the lives of my generation and my children's generation, that this can be really a force to bring us together and drive us together. And that brings me hope. That brings me a lot of hope. I think everybody has their part to play. You know, we're often looked up as youth leaders and even for adults and a lot of population. But over the 2 years, what I've realized, it's good for people to have leaders and visionaries to look up to. But they need to find their own hope, and they need to become their own leaders. That's what we're seeing mayors and governors doing over this country. But we need more of those, and we need more common citizens to not only sue their government, sue their state government, but also stand up in their streets and find out what they're going to do with their life and how it's going to help build a better future, whether it's in engineering or in agriculture or in science or in arts and writing or in journalism, like what we're doing today. And that brings me a lot of hope.
Michael Berger, what environmental situation in our final minute or two worries you most, and how do you think legal action could move the needle on that particular issue?
I mean, for me, climate change is the core issue that I'm working on these days, mm-hmm. And it is as Jacob was saying, it's a monumental problem that offers challenges on every front and great opportunities on every front as well. And so I think it requires real concerted, all-out effort, and it's an all-hands-on-deck kind of moment to address that problem. But fortunately, there are leaders of all ages who are taking charge and opening up pathways to a more sustainable future.
And Philip Gregory, with about 30 seconds left, what do you expect to be the next announcement? How soon?
We hope to get a decision in January. There's a great deal of urgency in making sure that this case goes to trial right away and that these kids can start see real change rather than promises and goals that are being set by people who have no intention of following through.
Philip Gregory, co-counsel for Giuliani v. United States, Jacob LaBelle from Southern Oregon and one of the 21 young plaintiffs in that case, and Michael Berger, executive director for the Sabin Center at Columbia Law School. Thank you all so much for joining us. Thanks for your calls. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call.